And are there any questions, first of all, on the specifically on the content?
That they didn't have the strength, they didn't have the arms, they didn't have the power to overcome the government. What happened was that France had been at war with Prussia. Prussia defeated France, and France decided that when its own workers rose up against the French government, they'd rather join forces with the Prussians than give in to their own workers. So the Prussian government was brought in to crush the communes. That was number one. But number two, they couldn't trade. They didn't have sufficient control over production. They couldn't take part in international trade. Had they gone on much longer, they would have been isolated. The peasant farmers outside of Paris, a surprisingly large number did support them, but many didn't. And they simply they were being starved out.
So they were basically ostracised by the society surrounding them?
Well, not by the society around them so much, but by the people who had power in the form of the state. That was the main problem. The Paris Commune, I mean, after the Paris Commune, there were terrible things written in the press claiming that the communards had killed thousands of state officials, most of which are now known to be completely untrue. There was a film on television, quite a bad film on television about it the other night, the Attica State Prison Riot. And after the Attica State Prison Riot, it was claimed that the prisoners had killed the prison warders who they held hostage and had castrated some of them and so on. In fact, all of the hostages who had been shot by the American police by accident when they were trying to hit the prisoners, and they'd given the prisoners the blame for it. The communards didn't kill people. In fact, in the days when the socialist standard, to let you into a secret, was more bold than it is perhaps these days, after the Paris Commune, Fitzgerald wrote an article saying the problem with the commune was not that they killed the officials, but they didn't kill enough of them. Well, I wouldn't know whether that's right or wrong. But in some ways, they had a point. If they would have killed a few more of them, they would have saved their own lives. That's one of those things. But what can be said was that there was no restraint in the brutality with which the commune was put down all over Europe. I mean, actually, it's very interesting because the government so overreacted in putting down the commune that it created a feeling of support for the communards all over Europe. And I mean, as early as 1904, early members of the Socialist Party apparently used to say that there was a man who used to attend the executive committee meetings in 1904 who was an old communard who used to sort of sit at the back saying, in the Paris Commune we would have done this and that. And apparently he was regarded with the utmost respect, whether he was a socialist or not. If you'd been in the commune, it was a sort of a passport on the lecture circuit for the next 20 years. And that's, quite seriously, it was a serious matter. It was an incredible attack. But it goes to show that the government, in overplaying its hand, does itself more damage, in the same way as, of course, the Ayatollah has done and the Shah had done. The Shah was so excessive in his brutality that even his friends like Jimmy Carter had to disown him, publicly at least. He's carried on trading with him.
Before I ask the next question, could we just thank you for a collection of 1224, which will be used to help finance these meetings? Another question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about this point about material conditions being right for a socialist revolution to be successful. Could you just tell me what the material conditions would be in your view? Because I think only came in half this one.
Well, there are two real material conditions. One is you've got to have sufficient economic development for there to be an abundant resources so that people can have produce for use, so that they can have free access. Because where you have a condition of not natural scarcity but technological scarcity, you can't provide enough for what people want. So a society of free access would break down within a short time. It would be chaos. So you've got to have abundance, which is why it's got to be on a world scale. And secondly, of course, you've got to have consciousness, because, you can't even... So those are the two things. And, I mean, the tragedy of history is that sometimes one occurs when the other doesn't. So in the Paris Commune, you had a quite high level of consciousness, but not the material conditions. But those are the two requisites for socialist society.
Why did the Mensheviks split into internationalists and defensors? For I mean, I understand the internationalist position, but why? What were the reasons behind the other,
Well, the defensors basically argued that, as is always a defence for a war, if you didn't support your own government, what you would get would be worse. It was quite hard to argue that in Russia because there wasn't much worse. But nevertheless, that's the position that they argued. And they also argue there's a certain amount of tactics in it. The argument was, if you support your own government, then you get a payoff after the war. And the government was saying that to them. You know, the Tsar was saying, if the progressive forces support the war, we'll support them. So in essence, they divided it into two parts. There were two groups of defensicists. One group left the Menshevik Party. They were known as the Unity Group, and people like that. In fact, Plekhanov, who we started with several weeks ago, months ago, he actually joined them. So that is a more less pleasant aspect to Plekhanov's political career. He supported the war wholeheartedly. The defence is split into two groups. One group wanted to win the war. The other group said, yes, you've got to lose the war. The other group said, the war's got to be brought to an end by a peace settlement. It was a sort of an equivalent to kind of multilateralism. You could really say it's like, if you take the three groups on defence policy in Britain today, unilateralists who want to pull out altogether, that was the internationalist position. Multilateralists who wanted to, the defensists, the main group of defensists, who wanted to end the war by agreement, and an extreme group of defences who simply wanted to win the war on the basis of national chauvinism. The other reason is that after February 1917, when the first revolution occurred, the first Soviet revolution occurred, they actually thought that they had something to defend. Because the revolution, I mean, February revolution is a vastly underrated political event. It was a massive change in Russia. The only reason, I mean, if it hadn't been for the October Revolution, everybody would look at the February Revolution as a major political development. It just happens that now everyone talks about October, because that is the one which has become part of Bolshevik mythology. But it's a very important event. And they were tricked. What happened was that the foreign minister in the provisional government, anyway, I don't know what his name was, he tricked them. And he wrote a note. The Soviets, after February 1917, as you probably know, there was dual power, where the provisional government held one half of power and the Soviets held the other. And the Soviets, the first act of the Soviets in March 1917 was to issue what was called Order Number 1, which was to all of the troops in the Russian army, which said that from now on, the aim of the Russian foreign policy was not to win the war, it was to bring about peace. And that you didn't have to obey the orders of the officers, you had to obey the orders of the Soviet. Well, what happened was that at the same time, Milyukov wrote a secret, who was part of the provisional government, wrote a secret note to the Allies, the Russian Allies, saying, don't worry about order number one and the Soviets, we're still behind you and we'll put in a lot of money to make sure this war is won. And when that note was in fact discovered in July 1917, this was what brought down the government in which Milyukov was the foreign minister, and it was the one which brought in Kerensky as prime minister. I think it was at the end of July 1917.
Can you, Mr. Speaker, define what Tsarist autocracy is?
Yes. Yeah. Well, an autocracy is simply a one man ruled by one person. And in the conditions of Russia, that was the Tsar. Who at that time was Nicholas II, and the Tsarist autocracy was the system whereby the what they had in Russia was not quite the same as feudalism in Britain. They'd never had feudalism in Russia. It was a different system where the court of the Tsar was the controller over all of the land in Russia, and they still had, unlike in Britain in the 19th century, the divine right of kings. In other words, the Tsar was supposed to be appointed by God, and he was Trotsky in his History of the Russian Revolution quite rightly, I think, argues that the best advert for the revolutionary movement in Russia was Rasputin. Because, in fact, again, it's interesting how so much of history is made by the ruling class simply overplaying their hand. Because what Trotsky argues, and Trotsky was a very good historian, was that, you know, in many ways, when he wasn't trying to cover up all the things he'd been involved in, he was good anyway. And what Trotsky argued was that they made such a fuss about how the Tsar had magical powers and everything the Tsar did was in direct contact with God, and they got the Tsar around all these peasant communities and he was touching them on the head and supposed to be curing them from the diseases, that people got so sick of this, they overplayed it. The English stopped doing it in 1714 with Queen Anne. She was the last queen to have what was called, you know, I forget what they called it, but it was a royal touch. People used to queue up outside Queen Anne's court, and Queen Anne would touch them on the head and, you know, make a blind see and a deaf ear and so on. After that, after Queen Anne, they gave it up to George I, basically because he couldn't speak English, he'd never been in England, so he couldn't do it. And after that, in fact, a lot of things ended with George I, but that's another story.
What are the practical chances of a revolution, as described by Martov, could ever take place? It seemed to me that a Bolshevik movement would often preempt them and put forward a revolution by the elite before conditions would be right for a Menshevik-style revolution.
Well, a revolution by an elite is not quite... You see, revolutions are never made by leadership, so they're made by followers. And the problem with that is that you're quite right. It's you can only get followers where people don't know what they're doing. And I think it's part of the process of history, frankly. When people need to follow, when they don't know what they're doing, they're going to follow someone. It's almost inevitable. And therefore, the logical answer to your question is when people understand what they want, they won't follow anyone. In one sense, don't misunderstand what I'm going to say, in Brixton last summer, when they had the riots, it was spontaneous. No one actually went out in the streets and said, come out and riot. People rioted. I mean, it's true, all the Trotskyists arrived about 2 weeks later and told them to riot, but by that time the riot was over. But nevertheless, it was spontaneous. In February 1917, it was spontaneous. What happened was that there were food riots on the streets of St. Petersburg. One army unit was told by a particularly objectionable officer, go out and shoot them. And they happened to be their own relatives and friends. They turned around the army officer and said, no. He said, I order you to do it. They shot him. The next thing he had was a bloody revolution. So in other words, what actually happens is that it's very, very much to do with the way in which people see the way ahead, the sense of direction on the part of people. Now, we obviously don't kid ourselves in the Socialist Party that the majority of workers do understand and want socialism. Certainly they don't. What we can say is that the rational capacity for mass understanding does exist. There's nothing inevitable about following. There's nothing inevitable about the crowd always being in the rear guard. And once you actually break through the level of historical reasoning where you say, well, that's not inevitable, then you say, well, if it's not inevitable, it's possible. Well, if it's possible, when is it going to happen? Well, it's going to happen when people want it to happen. Do I want it to happen? Well, I do, or I wouldn't be here. You must be a bit interested, or you wouldn't still be here. You had a chance to get out here anyway. So therefore, you start thinking about it. Well, do I want it? What do I want? Society where you've got classes? Well, you don't mind a society where you've got classes if you're in the ruling class. If you're not, you don't like the sound of it. Do you want wars? No. Do you want unemployment? No. Do you want wage slavery? Not if you're a wage slave. And so it goes on. And eventually you come out and you say, well, I don't need the society we've got at the present. I want a different one. And then you start to establish it. And then if I come through the door and I say to you, now hang on, what you want is a society without war, a society without unemployment, a society without classes, follow me. You say, no, I don't need to, I already know that. I know what I want. And once that's happened, you simply can't lead people. And that is what we're talking about. And we're talking at all times about the reliance which Marx was concerned with on the ability of people to think and to govern their own thinking. As soon as you reject that ability, then it's a very, very big problem. You're entering into an area where, as I would argue, you've got no alternative than slope, which eventually leads down towards fascism. Because eventually, at the end of the day, you start with benign government, you end with malevolent dictatorship. And there's no avoiding that. So that rational capacity is what stops it. There are no inevitable cycles or patterns in history. The only thing which is inevitable in history is the necessity for change and the capacity for consciousness.
And yet we repeatedly see Kim Il-sung, a Tito in power, a few instances such as Poland, where the workers' movement does bring forth the so-called communist establishment has plenty of power to crush it and then some. Is there a realistic chance that this kind of revolution can go through, or is repression from the left too heavy?
Well, I tell you what. Look, you and I, and even the oldest, the oldest amongst us, there's only very old amongst us, but the oldest amongst us as a human race, we're young, we're kids, historically speaking. Look how long the Earth has been here. I don't know how long it's been in the man sitting next to you, probably.
4,600 million years.
Right. He's been counting every second.
I know it's a year.
Right. So, the Earth has been here a long time. Years and years, hundreds of years of slavery, feudalism. We've had capitalism for a very short time. And what's happened within capitalism is that people have tended to reflect the capitalist methods of revolution in socialist experiments. So what's tended to happen, understandably, is that what Lenin did was Lenin looked at the French Revolution, which was a capitalist revolution, or the English Revolution. Well, the English Revolution was different from all other revolutions because there was no bloodshed in it. The English got the Dutch to die in our revolution. The English always either get the Dutch or the Irish to die in our revolution, you see. So what happened there was that the tendency has been to look back to the past for a way ahead. But capitalism is young. What we're arguing is not obviously simply about prediction, because you can read predictions in horoscopes. What we are arguing is about historical possibilities and the ways of solving contradictions which exist. And if there is a contradiction between a system which is giving rise to exploitation and a group of exploited people who don't want to be exploited, then the only resolution of that contradiction is for that group of exploited people to get rid of that system. And the fact that that hasn't happened before is largely because what happened in Tito, with Tito in Yugoslavia or the African dictatorships, has been that these men have been brought in to build up capital. It has been a process of developing capitalism. In parts of the world, Marxism is regarded as a very, very good idea. After all, Marxism is a bit like Christianity, so you know, there's a lot of nice, pious sound to it. It's good. You know, workers are getting a bit tired of being told you've got to do things in the name of God, when you're told you're doing it in the name of classlessness, equality, fraternity, and so on. This is very good. And when somebody like Robert Mugabe stands up and says, you know, you've all got to work hard, you mustn't have trade unions, this is great. I mean, President Reagan, if he would have caught on to the Marxist idea, would have been delighted, I'm sure, to have used it. But it, you know, I don't think quite fits in with the image. So when it comes to it, what we're saying is that it's necessary now to talk in terms, not of people listening to somebody else putting an idea, but people themselves taking ideas and using them for themselves. Is that possible? The only way in which we can say it's not possible is if we've shown that it's not. It's very hard to show that anything is possible. It's much easier to show that it's impossible. In other words, I can demonstrate to you with no doubt whatsoever that if you want to recreate feudalism, you'll have a very hard job. If you want to establish socialism, capitalism is doing the job for us. It's providing all of the problems. It's providing us with a movement of people who are dissatisfied. It's providing contradictions. It's developing the means of production to the level where we can produce in abundance. Capitalism is doing the job. The only problem is that it can not only create the means of a solution, it can also create the means of destruction, because it can wipe the whole lot out in one go.
Are there any other points which anyone would like to raise? Possibly referring back to some of the other.
Yes. You said something about, well, Marta called it earlier, about the Mensheviks actually supporting the, well, after 1917, supporting the new current policy. What were the reasons behind them actually doing so?
No, actually, it was just some. After 1917, the Mensheviks split all over the place, and some of them had advocated. I mean, what they advocated, quite realistically as far as I'm concerned, was, you see, there were two groups of Bolsheviks after 1917. There were the ones based in Petrograd and the ones based in Moscow. The ones based in Petrograd basically accepted Lenin's idea. The ones based in Moscow, they still had these ideals. They were people like Bukharin and so on. And they were actually arguing. Bukharin was sending telegrams from Moscow to Petrograd saying, when are we going to have a moneyless society? And Lenin was sort of sending a telegram back saying, don't be so daft. And, of course, what happened was, that there was that split. Well, amongst the Mensheviks, there were those who... Lenin was, of course, reasonably realistic. Lenin wrote, as you know, if we could get state capitalism in Russia, it would be a step forward. He knew that socialism just wasn't on the cards in 1917. He had to face up to that. His condemnation is not on the basis of ignorance, it's on the basis of dishonesty, which is a far worse condemnation, I would say. What the Mensheviks argued, they were quite honest as well, and what they said was, look, here you are, you're stuck with the government, you've got no alternative but to put up with running capitalism. Now, what you want to do is, and then they started to outline the new economic policy. And the new economic policy was a lot better in terms of capitalist administration to what existed before 1921. It's during the period of what economic historians have called war communism. There was absolute economic chaos. I mean, there were people starving by the hundreds of thousands. After the NEP was introduced, there was at least a relative degree of economic stability from a capitalist point of view, whatever economic stability means, at least for the peasants anyway. But that some of the Mensheviks had advocated this. And Lenin was always very annoyed. You see, prior to 1917, there had been the policy of what was called the Black Repartition, which was advocated by the peasants' organisation, the Narodniks. And they argued that every peasant should have his own strip of land. That was a traditional, almost semi-religious demand of the Russian peasants going back for centuries, before the time of the emancipation of the serfs in 1861. And what happened was that the Black Repartition was stolen by Lenin and the Bolsheviks after October 1917. What they did was they passed a land decree which said that every peasant should have his own strip of land. And that was the means by which they won the peasants over to the revolution. And in fact, the peasants would not have supported the Russians during the Civil War had it not been for them taking the old peasant policy, which they had to get rid of when the Civil War was over after 1921. What actually happened, I've probably said this before, but the Bolshevik Party changed its name in, I think, 1919 to the Communist Party. And many peasants in Russia used to say, we love the Bolsheviks, but we can't stand the Communists. They didn't realise it was the same party, because it was the Bolsheviks who gave them the land in 1917. It was the Communists who took it away from them soon afterwards, and they didn't realise it was the same party. Unfortunately, one of the problems about peasant communities is that they don't have much of a written history, and peasants, practically every other generation, peasants are caught on exactly the same trick. Peasants are always believing that when they're given land by a government which wants stability for a while, they're going to keep it. As soon as a government... The thing about peasants is peasants very rarely organise very efficiently, and therefore it's very, very easy to trick peasants left, right and centre, because once you actually want land taken away from them, they're so divided, there are no trade unions. That's why, to some extent, rural solidarity was quite an interesting phenomenon, because it was an attempt by some of the smaller peasants in Poland to actually defend themselves against collectivization, which is still probably due to come in Poland.
Any other contributions anyone would like to make? If you have any points to make about previous meetings in the series, we want to welcome those as well. Well, in that case, it might be an idea to draw the meeting to a close early, because we haven't transported that easy anyhow. So I'd like to again thank the speaker on behalf of the people here. I'm sure everyone would agree that we've had a series of very stimulating talks covering the introduction to socialist thought. Before I ask the speaker to sum up for tonight and for the end of the series, I would just point out that any ideas which any of you may have for future suggestions for future meetings we might run would always be gratefully received and given consideration by us as a branch. There is literature available at the back, so if there aren't any other points, then I'll ask Harry Coleman to sum up tonight.
Right, well, I only want to sum up on two or three very, well, to start with, two fairly localised points about these meetings. First of all, I just want to say I would like to thank Edwin for all the readings of the quotations which he's done over the weeks that we've had this, because they have been extremely good. They've not only given you a break from my voice, but more importantly, they've given me a break from it. And so that's one thing. Secondly, I am actually one of the things in relation to what was just said by the chairman, which I'd like to organise perhaps in the spring or summer of next year, is a series similar to this one, dealing with thinkers who we would oppose rather than the ones we've dealt with, who are people who we've perhaps had more in common with, perhaps looking at the ideas of some of the writers and like Edmund Burke and Mussolini and Ramsay MacDonald and all your favourite Christmas characters we can deal with. So we can start with those. But the other thing I want to actually say in conclusion, there's not many people here, is that if there was one thing that does actually run right the way through all of the talks that have been given here, it is this point about history not having something to do with the past, but having something to do with the key to the future. And one of the terrible things about studying history in schools is that by the time you finish doing it, you've just about got up to the present if you stay on for long enough. You don't actually ever get on to the future. And the reason for that is that most people leave school and are actually expected to go out into the world and simply recreate the same mistakes that people have made for years and generations before them. And one of the things which education in the socialist movement is about is not recreating the mistakes of the past, but actually learning from them and doing something about making the future. And without any doubt, the most creative human activity conceivable is the production of the future.